Hello, and welcome to the Using Partnerships to Accelerate Mission Objectives webinar, presented by Postonelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website. During today's webinar, you will be asked to answer a CLE polling question. In order to receive your CLE certificate of attendance, you must answer the polling question. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours after the webinar to all those who answered the polling question. Please use the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers throughout the webinar. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Postonelli shareholder, Lori Oliver.
Good morning and thanks everyone for joining us. As Ashley indicated, we'll take questions through the chat box if we have time or otherwise follow up with you. So welcome. So what we wanted to accomplish today is we wanted to spend a bit of time just kind of recognizing the ongoing healthcare environment and different activities ongoing. And then we've created a framework for how to think about when partnership might be an option to consider to accelerate your organization's ability. So as we talk through that framework, you will see there's a lot of crossover, but we wanted to create an opportunity to focus in on how partnerships can help diversify care locations, increase your efficiency, or drive reimbursement. And then the second half of the webinar, we'll be reviewing some of the regulatory considerations that come into play with transactions like these. And we will have slides on a variety of the laws, but we're really going to focus in on four specific areas that have either some recent activity or are heavy hitters in this space. So with that, why look for a partner? So we pulled a few data points here from surveys and experts nationally. And I think what you'll see in here is there's competing concepts and assessments at play, which really reflect the reality of the marketplace. So in these, you can see that there's a recognition that many healthcare organizations have limited funds and need to invest strategically, and that having a partner to do a similar investment can assist in moving along the activity. There's a recognition that there's a lot of risk and uncertainty, and so you see in the M&A space, merger and acquisitions, that activity is still continuing, but some of the more robust activity is in smaller transactions, which is not to say that bigger transactions are not occurring, but you're seeing an effort to take advantage of strategic opportunities but also mitigate risk. And then you really see also a recognition of skill gaps. So I think we're all being exposed to a lot of dialogue and surveys related to telehealth activity in particular and digital health. It's striking the assessment of similar to this Guidehouse survey of how many predict this is the wave of the future that they need to be very robust in and yet feeling very unprepared for that next phase. So in thinking about, I don't think we would have said this before, but pre-COVID, we certainly had a lot more certainty when we were looking at the tea leaves and thinking about what are strategic initiatives that your organizations might be engaged in or their assessment of market opportunities. So as we think about where we are now, some of these are still the same push-pulls that we're experiencing when an organization is thinking about, should I do this activity all on my own or do I need a partner to help? So when we think about this snapshot, you know, it highlights that, you know, we have less certainty perhaps than we felt 3 or 4 months ago. We're seeing accelerated trends that require us to either respond to those trends or continue to be on the front end of them. There are new variables at play. So I don't think 4 months ago we were worried about patients who didn't want to come into healthcare facilities for care. And there's a need for new financial investments that really come at a terrible time for many organizations. So As you are thinking about your community and keeping your consumer slash patient in mind, we wanted to share some of the activities that we're seeing nationally and regionally, and focus in on those opportunities a little bit. So maybe one takeaway we do know is I think pretty much everyone agrees that healthcare is not returning to its pre-COVID state, despite the language we might use about returning to the status quo or, you know, a new baseline. So as we look forward, I would suggest, and Jim and I want to talk through, how do you view your activities with the question of could a strategic partner allow you to innovate more quickly, pivot to meet a community need, engage consumers and the activities they're focusing on, and respond to disruptors in the market. So, Jim, I'm going to hand off to you to take the next slide.
Thank you, Lori. Now we'll talk about, you know, the variety of partnership structures that are available. Really, you're limited only by your imagination and, unfortunately, the rather Byzantine healthcare regulatory environment. Typically, with the legal structures, you can see partnerships come in various contractual forms. Most common and probably the lowest risk are vendor contracts, whether that be, you know, just in a straight service provider for your digital health products, get management services agreements, joint operating agreements are available, as well as some contractual joint ventures. With respect to the ownership, you know, you have, you know, your traditional equity joint venture, where you've got multiple parties investing in an organization. You can do a swap out of members or shareholders, which is a way that here in Washington we do a lot of deals where a shareholder or the member is substituted so that a UBI is not changed, and so you can avoid some of the licensure change of ownership issues. You can create wholly owned subsidiaries, or you can just do a straight line acquisition. You know, I think, as Lori mentioned, given the new environment, it seems that the contractual or other types of ventures where you're not having to invest as much money are likely going to be in focus. You will see some acquisitions, and I think some of those acquisitions are likely to be more the fire sale type, where you do see, you know, one side maybe has some money, another side wants to stay in business or wants to figure out how to transfer their risk, or they're losing too much money and they don't have the deep pockets. So those kinds of relationships, you may see those on a smaller scale, but it would be surprising to see the massive organizational acquisitions other than perhaps through bankruptcies over the next couple of years. So when you're talking about your choice of legal structure, I think you're really balancing multiple factors. One, there's governance considerations, whether you have clinical integration opportunities, which is paramount, the economics. How do you fund this deal? What's the best way to fund it? Do you have the funding? How quickly can you bring it to market? How quickly can you, you know, pivot in order to implement this new product or your partnership? What's going to be the branding issues? Do you have tax exempt status concerns? Do you have legal authority? That comes more significantly into play when you're dealing with, I think, public entities. And then what are the market dynamics? Is this something that the market's going to accept or not? You know, for example, in our area, in, you know, Seattle, we're kind of a society of tech nerds. And so, you know, digital health and other issues that may be more difficult to implement in other areas may be easier here in Seattle. You know, when Microsoft and Amazon can turn into remote working overnight, that should give you some idea of the complexity of our ability to work remotely and to interact remotely as we're all learning here. When you're thinking about the choice of legal structures, in my view, what has undone more deals than that I thought would be really good with equal partners is governance consideration and control. And I think people are going to have to figure out how to overcome the need to control absolutely everything in order to pivot more quickly and to have more of a entrepreneurial disruptor mindset to move forward. But again, those abilities can be limited significantly by the legal structure or the status of the organization. So as Lori had mentioned, we're going to talk about kind of a few topics that we're seeing trending one way or another. And the first is digital health. Now, as we know, digital health is something we've been talking about for multiple years and trying to implement in an appropriate setting. You know, you've got various strategies that have been out there, but those strategies have been accelerated because of the national emergency. You've got national companies that are coming in, you think, to provide care delivery. You've got, think of United and Optum and how they are, one, controlling and hiring providers. They've got the telemedicine network. They've got their behavioral health network. You've got all of these strategies that were being implemented that have are now being reimbursed and are the focus of a lot of activity and necessary activity. And it's pretty clear that I think the patient base is going to expect to be able to continue to access digital health. And part of that comes, you know, from innovation and the disruptors that are in the industry. So they come out and they have more of a entrepreneurial mindset that, and they take risk. And I'll say traditional healthcare, not always great about taking risk. You know, it's all the traditional healthcare providers tend to be very risk averse for a reason, but that also can make it very difficult for them to innovate. And innovation means coming up and putting money into something that may not be successful or that has a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. And that's very difficult when you're dealing with limited money and staffing capabilities. Examples of digital health, we've got increase in telemedicine visits, remote patient monitoring, online care management portals, chat and text. And, there's a lot of subscription services that are out there that deal with, give you access to chat and text on a daily basis. Whether it be for, for mental health services, whether it be for primary care, just a nice plan that gives you immediate access and then helps you to kind of triage whether or not you need to go actually to a facility and deal with both the inconvenience and what now is perceived as a risk of increased likelihood or exposure to COVID-19. Let's see, another area is just, partnerships in the ambulatory setting. We've seen the acceleration just because of, let me step back. It's a long-term concept where you're moving healthcare from the more costly inpatient service to the ambulatory setting, whether it be, outpatient surgeries. You've got a whole bunch of outpatient surgeries now that used to be inpatient. That is a kind of a battle that the CFOs have been fighting forever. You want to have as much inpatient care as you can because you get better reimbursement generally. But we now recognize with improvements with medicine, patient desires that ambulatory surgery and ambulatory care is much more desirable. In addition to just the ambulatory surgery centers, you are seeing expansions of alternative treatment settings due to the COVID emergency, just so we can make sure that the hospitals don't overflow. And that's, you know, resulted in certain changes so that hospital-based services or hospital-like services can be provided in alternative facilities. Then, you know, I think there's all other disruptors that have been out that are dealing with the alternative care model. For example, whether it be infusion at the home rather than an infusion center, whether it be, you know, kind of a daily, or doctors that provide home office visits or home visits to provide healthcare services for somebody who cannot make it to the facility in order to improve care. Those are all partnerships, ideas, concepts that are currently out there that, you know, clearly with the current status of the healthcare emergency and the market are going to expand exponentially. And, you know, as we're seeing, people don't want to come to the hospitals unless they have to. They don't want to go into a facility and rub elbows with someone else if they don't have to. So I think those who have planned and thought about these concepts, like with the digital health, they are getting, reaping the rewards for their risk that have been expedited due to this national health emergency. And now I will turn it over to
while we're flipping the slide to shift gears to post-acute care, I just add to, on the digital health perspective, that it's impressive to watch the behavioral health field and some of the innovations that are happening there. And you're probably actually seeing the advertisements on TV, just like I am, for different behavioral health apps where you can get counseling in your home. So there are a lot of ways that in an area where there are scarce resources in terms of access to psychiatrists or psychologists, that folks who are not traditionally in healthcare are making inroads into that space in a way that if you do provide behavioral healthcare treatment, you might want to focus on. So shifting gears to post-acute care and home health, and I'm going to kind of talk about these together, but I'll try to stay on a particular slide. But they intertwine quite a bit because of the activity in focusing on, can we do that service in a patient's home? So the framework in which I look through these different things is thinking about, are there new business opportunities for your organization as one thinks about these areas? Is there an acceleration of a trend that you can either be part of the leading edge of, or you need to respond to from a competitive perspective? And are there opportunities in some of the technology that's being developed for a particular purpose to use to manage increasingly complex workforce issues? So in the behavior post-acute strategy area, I wanted to highlight a few areas in which kind of fit in that general framework. So the first does not sound particularly innovative, but it is an example of an organization that was able to, because of COVID, they pretty much turned over a two-week period and retooled all of their EMR templates, et cetera, to be able to provide online services that would be reimbursed and mitigate the level of financial loss they were experiencing. It's a national hospital chain who's actually not a client. And through that, what they tapped into, which is a new service for them, is medical director services. So with so many of these venues not basically locking down and not allowing anyone who didn't need to be there, they were looking for physicians and clinicians and others who could provide the service remotely rather than come into the facility. So in their setting, this was a new business opportunity for them that they were ideally positioned, and now they have a long waiting list of organizations who'd like to tap into those services. There are a number of examples of what I would call home recovery care, and here's where I put this in the category of an accelerating trend, because these actually are not new. They are activities and initiatives that have been going on for some time. And by home recovery care, the definition that I'm using is inpatient eligible services that are being done without being in a hospital or a skilled nursing facility. And really a response to consumerism, and some of the waivers are helping accelerate that activity. And while if I'm channeling a CFO, we don't know how long those waivers will last, it's striking that these are actually not new activities. Another example that called hospital at home type services is a Johns Hopkins model that has been in place since 1995. So again, not new. They've been testing the delivery of hospital-like services in the home. They're showing through research a 30% reduction in cost. So there are opportunities for organizations that are well positioned to push into this space and or partner with a hospital who knows how to deliver hospital services. There are also a variety of organizations that are focused on how do we provide complete in-home care is how their marketing structured, but they started in the mobile urgent care space and they're expanding out and they're being recognized by consumers as offering a service outside of the context of traditional insurance. So I was struck by my mother in a longer-term care facility and, you know, seeing Dispatch, which is a organization we've probably all seen their cars roaming around, being suggested as a resource to them, just entirely outside of the traditional healthcare context of what your insurance might cover. So those are disruptors that are well positioned to be making a shift in our environment. And then if you're in a rural area, there are a lot of opportunities to put digital health to work, and seeing some of the in Washington, the rural palliative care initiative that's helping rural providers design workflows so that they can do these services through telemedicine. So there are different ways folks are thinking about how not to have a patient in a particular facility environment and to keep them in the home. So if we turn to home health strategies as well. I just wanted to highlight that, you know, here's an area where through some of the waivers, we're seeing the ability to do like hospice recertifications through telemedicine. My prediction is that that's going to work well enough that that will continue to be the new going forward status quo as we stabilize from all of the COVID activities. Another example I think that's worth highlighting is dialysis. So different facilities provide dialysis care. You've got hospitals that do it. You have dialysis facilities. And CMS has been already engaged through kidney care innovation projects and pilots and reimbursement changes, trying to create the metrics, incentives, and framework to move more dialysis out of the hospital and out of dialysis facilities and into the home with physician visits to the home. And now what we're seeing with the waivers is they've jumped over the physician visits to the home, and that's being done through telehealth. And there is a framework there to capture that data to show whether that is providing just as effective care with reduced costs. So it's an example of, you know, the old lens I would suggest might have been provider-based versus freestanding, and where is the care best able to be delivered? And I would say shift your lens to provider-based freestanding or in the home, because there's a lot of interest in moving the care to the home, and we've seen it in the space of cancer infusion and then you know, overlapping with the slide before, you know, acute care services, how to move those activities into the home. So a lot going on in that space. And a lot of ways, if you're a hospital, you might think about how do you position and partner strategically to retain those patients in some form or another. So that kind of is the section of where we are thinking about partnerships to diversify your care delivery locations. And obviously that overlaps with this slide in terms of what are partnerships that can help you improve how you provide the services in terms of increasing your efficiency, reducing your cost, furthering patient satisfaction. And if I had thought to add the fourth bullet of physician, clinician satisfaction, we'd have the quadruple aim there, which is obviously something all of your organizations are focused on. Some of these examples are not new activities, but they are things that are either the trend is accelerating or folks are thinking about it more seriously than they previously did. So in the first example of strategic sourcing, and by that I mean picking one partner for multiple activities, so it is less of a vendor relationship and more of a, I have a strategic partnership and through that I, you know, outsource my revenue cycle and procurement or whatever the example might be, that there's an uptick in some of that activity. Artificial intelligence, hard to miss all of the news coverage about different opportunities that may be out there and predictions about how we can use automation to reduce expenses, reduce human error, be consumer friendly. So how can you use that to plan for surges and manage your patient flow in a time where just showing up at the ED is not always the best option? You know, if you have developed a value-based care platform that you've been using in your risk-based contracts, how can you expand that to the broader population to engage and manage in a different way that COVID is requiring? And could a strategic partner allow you to accelerate that journey? So we're seeing some organizations exploring that deliberately in a different way than they were pre-COVID. And we left to Jim the really challenging topic of how do you use partnerships to drive reimbursement. So I'll turn it over to Jim.
Thank you, Lori. This is one of the areas that's the most perplexing to me. We've been working, yes, I've been practicing law for 25 years, and in that entire time in the healthcare area, we've been trying to figure out how to get payers and providers to work together more effectively to improve care, to reduce costs, and man, it is like pulling teeth. I have, you know, when I've dealt with multiple contracts, and in fact, I was just dealing with an arrangement. I thought we had a great arrangement worked out, and the payer just said, wait, you know, this isn't something we do, and we're not going to really take this risk. And I'm sitting here scratching my head saying, but aren't you in the business of risk? And it doesn't, you know, everybody else in the group that we've been working on this agreement thinks that what we put together will really create a strong partnership. But the COO of the health plan came in and said, nah, this isn't quite what we do, and I don't want to move forward. So it's an ongoing struggle. I think it's going to be more difficult because right now the providers are suffering from the current, you know, lack of outpatient services, the moratoriums on providing services, but the payers get a windfall, you know, because they're not having to pay for the care. So it creates some inequities, I think, and those inequities are really what, in my opinion, cause agreements to fail. But examples of where we could potentially be moving forward, and we should be moving forward with, between payers and providers, are thinking about how do you, you know, improve cost and effectiveness? You know, can you use bundles? Can you say, here, we're going to give you this payment bundle for these types of episodes of care? Does that make sense? Are we going to increase or retain the digital, you know, the reimbursement for digital services? Can we improve sites of services and make sure that the reimbursement is appropriate for the provider, that it recognizes something that may be new? Everybody, I think, understands what costs are when you're dealing with inpatient services, and in most instances, outpatient services. But when you're going into new areas, new sites of service, how do you, you know, evaluate and come to an arrangement as to appropriate negotiation? And are there new forms of reimbursement that you can think of? You know, can you transition? So I think most people that are able to control their cost and control through appropriate protocols, provider referrals and usage can really take advantage of some strong per member, just full risk agreements where they're accepting a per member per month fee. And if they manage that effectively, they can actually do quite well. Now, all of these, you know, evaluating, deciding, working through risks related to relationships with payers and new payment approaches requires access to data. You know, garbage in, garbage out. So that's one of the key factors, and it's still a struggle, I think, to get access to the data from the payers. Some are very good about it and do want to have the partnership. Some are very difficult. And I think that, you know, even though we've been trying for years and years, we've got to continue to try. But I think you can see some of the failures when, you know, United creates its own branch through Optum to control more of the providers and have more say, potentially leaving out those who are in the community and creating a struggle for those in the community. But, you know, in order to be successful, the party is going to have to come together, and that requires leverage from both sides. And creating that leverage and creating an appropriate discussion on how to evaluate and come to some agreement related to payers and providers and create the win-wins is going to be driven by the data, your access to data, how good you can manipulate the data and understand your data and move forward with respect to adequate proposals, predicting what the responses are going to be from the payers. So examples for the payers and providers, clinically integrated networks, I think that's something that could and should work. But again, we still struggle with getting those in place and getting those into a situation where it works for the payer, it works for the hospital, it works for the primary care providers and the specialists. It just has been a continued struggle, but it's something that I think, you know, given the current environment, given the cost, given, you know, unemployment issues, that both the payers and the providers are going to have to continue to try to evaluate and work together despite the lack of, in some cases, respect or like for one another.
Okay, so, oops, sorry, Jim and I are both flipping at the same time.
Yes, and I'll turn it back over to Dr. Lori.
Great, thanks. So thinking about your risk considerations. So as we turn our attention to the legal and regulatory environment that we work in, I would suggest a good starting point, whether you're in operations or you're in legal, is starting with the why. Why do you want to do this? What's the value it brings? And keep asking the why at different levels, because the risk is embedded in that and will help you manage and think about how to structure the transaction as you're looking to mitigate any risk that there might be interference with the clinical decision making, for example, or reducing patient choice. Unfortunately, lawyers are often blamed for killing the deal, but I think if you're walking through this from a risk perspective and asking these questions, it will help you think about how to structure the deal in a way that has less risk from a regulatory perspective. So as we shift gears, we're not going to walk through each and every law, although we're going to do a general overview, but we're going to focus in on four key areas, and that being there's a new anti-kickback statute at the federal level that we wanted to be sure everyone was aware of. We're going to talk about the OIG fraud alert in particular, tax-exempt and public entity status, and then antitrust. So I'm going to turn the key laws to consider over to Jim, but that's what's ahead for our next 25 minutes together.
Great. Thank you, Lori. So as I discussed earlier when we were talking about partnerships and structural options, whether it be contractual or in equity or ownership, I did mention the rather extensive and Byzantine set of laws that can impact your legal structure and what you can and can't do. And we always have to keep in mind that these laws pretty much are counterintuitive to what any other business would do. You've got your anti-kickback statute, your fraud laws, where if you have a referral source, you cannot you can't pay them for the referrals. Everybody else in the world does, but we can't. We'll talk about, so we've got the anti-kickback statute, the Stark Law, False Claims Act, civil monetary penalty laws. As Lori mentioned, we'll go over the OIG fraud alert on contractual joint ventures. I think that has, it's a oldie but a goldie. It has a lot of, just good structural analysis that you should consider when you're entering into any kind of partnership or joint venture. We've got the tax-exempt issues. That's an area that we'll talk about because most providers traditionally are tax-exempt, and there are a lot of restrictions on how they can and cannot move forward with arrangements, especially when they're dealing with for-profit organizations. Antitrust is always an issue, whether it's a clinical integrated network or, as we've seen, when you're dealing in acquisition, whether it was St. Luke's in Idaho or the doctor's clinic, you've seen some activity that we would not have necessarily expected when you're trying to work through various partnerships to improve the care or services in a location. Death court practice in medicine, I think that's an often overlooked area. Because the corporate practice of medicine is alive and well here in Washington State, and it's really limiting, and there's not much good guidance on where the corporate practice of medicine doctrine stops. We've made arguments for hospitals. We can make arguments for other licensed organizations, but then you've got your friendly PCs, other options that you consider and have to consider when you're thinking about new arrangements or partnerships. Conditions of participation can drive how you set up your organizational structure. Do you need a certificate of need? You've got state licensure issues, accreditation, reimbursement issues. How are you going to be reimbursed, especially if this is a new product line? Standards of practice, as Lori mentioned in her prior slide, is this going to improve patient care? Is it within the standard of practice? And, or are you pushing the limits of the standard of practice or licensure rules? And then we always have to keep in mind the HIPAA privacy and security rules. So with that said, I'll turn it over to Lori.
Okay, thanks, Jim. So here's where we're gonna bounce through a few slides really quickly. You have them, but what is striking to me when you pause is we have a lot of anti-kickback statutes. So we obviously have the federal one that we're most familiar with for federal healthcare programs. And there is a state level corollary in Washington as well. But I wanted to talk about this new anti-kickback statute. because it applies to all healthcare benefit programs. So it applies to all payers. It is not limited to federal, and it affects a slice of the healthcare environment. So it's prohibiting kickbacks in exchange for referrals to recovery homes, which are shared living environments if you're in a different part of the healthcare space, clinical treatment facilities, which are entities that provide care for substance abuse issues, or laboratories. So super broad, almost everyone deals with laboratories in some way. It's new in the sense it came into effect in 2018. It has some statutory safe harbors, just like the other anti-kickback statute. Has no regulatory safe harbors yet. But what is of note is it is not identical to the Medicare, Medicaid, anti-kickback statute. So if you are dealing with labs, treatment facilities, or recovery homes, really important to pause and take a look at the safe harbors here as you're structuring a transaction. It has just had, in 2020, its first prosecution for a kickback for referrals for urine drug testing. So it involved a laboratory, and the sentencing was in May. So it didn't involve large dollars. So the woman who was sentenced did receive, however, despite that, 5 months in jail, 5 months in home confinement, and then 3 years total for supervision of her activities. So it is a criminal statute, and they do appear willing to put people in jail. So it's worth highlighting in case you were not aware of this, to be sure to put this on your checklist for laws you should consider and take a look at. So now we're pausing for our question you need to answer for CLE credit. So we're going to pause for a moment. Okay, I think we've got most folks have answered. I think you can continue to answer even though we're going to move to the next slide. So as I noted, there is a anti-kickback statute in Washington. So, and your checklist, be sure you don't just have all the federal laws but are including the unique aspects of Washington. And now we are going to, and you know, certainly if you have a physician involved, you wanna pay attention to the Stark Law. There's a state corollary to that as well. There's an anti-rebating statute in Washington. So while it doesn't, you don't see a lot of discussion on it, there are some cases, there are Attorney General's Office opinions, so it's important to look at that one as well. And a turnover to Jim to talk about why we're highlighting this OIG advisory opinion, even though it is not recent, but in the space of partnerships, very pertinent. So, Jim?
Yeah, thank you, Lori. As I had mentioned, this has been on the books for quite some time, the advisory bulletin regarding contractual joint ventures, and sometimes people, I think about it, the regulation or the bulletin was published in the Federal Register in 1994. But I think some of the issues that were raised continue to be issues and can help you identify suspect arrangements when you're thinking about whether it be a contractual or an equity venture with referral sources or other organizations. And some of the concepts not only applied in the with respect to the fraud and abuse laws, but I think they are issues that can carry over into tax exempt status as well. So when you look through and you think about, you know, what are some of the suspect arrangements that they identified, and some of these are common sense. You know, you're choosing your investors based upon referrals. Are you require them to divest their interests if they don't refer, or lose their ownership if they leave the service area? Similar concepts. You have kind of shell companies that are suspect business structures. They give a DME example where, you know, if it, where one party owns, you know, all the equipment and provides all the services, but another party is somehow, you know, getting some kind of reimbursement really for the referrals, you know. Or another example that they do is a laboratory example where you may have a standing lab, and that standing lab bills for all the services, but all the actual laboratory services are conducted offsite. And then, you know, other suspect issues that are raised in the advisory bulletin would be, you know, is the amount of investment versus the returns, are they disproportionate? And are referring investors permitted to borrow of the investment and paid back through profits? That's, you know, creates concerns that you're just paying for the referrals, as well as this could create some concerns with respect to your tax exempt status. The next issue that we'll just touch on are the antitrust issues. You know, antitrust and enforcement of antitrust guidelines are, you know, increasing. I think there was a time where the enforcement was pretty active, and you know, then there was a little bit of a pause, and now I think it's ramped back up. So the laws you're concerned with are, you know, the Sherman Act, and that's really a contract, a combination, takes two parties to either fix prices or boycott, or enter into exclusive dealing arrangements. That's an area that you have to be concerned about when you're creating, you know, merging two providers, and they're not, if it's a merger, but if you have, that's fine, but if it's a contractual arrangement, or you're working through a clinically integrated network through a separate organization, the antitrust laws are going to be imperative, and it's going to be the Sherman Act that you most likely need to be concerned with in that section one. Section two is unlawful to monopolize. That takes only one party. It doesn't prohibit monopoly power, but it prohibits the abuse of monopoly power. And I think that's kind of the key that happened with respect to St. Luke's, and seems to be the focus of the ultimate settlement with the doctor's clinic issue as well. So the antitrust considerations are really important. From the federal standpoint, you have, you know, kind of a catch-all Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act that prohibits any inappropriate, deceptive, or unfair practices. I don't know that that comes in other than as kind of a bootstrap. So enforcement of the antitrust laws, you can get substantial fines, criminal and imprisonment. That's brought by the Department of Justice. That's why it's important to really focus on these issues. And then civilly, actions can be brought by the government. They can be brought by an individual. And there are substantial fines and penalties and damages that can be collected. You know, a private party can collect three times the damages plus attorney's fees. And in a lot of the cases where there is antitrust involvement, somebody who's just not happy with the deal, somebody who feels like they lost out because there is a monopoly, they're the ones who initiate the claim. So you have to be very careful to think through those issues where you're coming, you know, you're bringing your partnership considerations to bear. One other thing to think about when you're dealing with, especially if you're dealing with a private organization and a state entity, is the enforcement against state entities is a little different. the federal government can't bring, nor can an individual get damages from a state entity due to constitutional restrictions. For a state entity or a governmental entity, including a public hospital district, the only action that could happen would be an injunction if they're violating the Antitrust Act. Plus, the party bringing the claim could seek attorney's fees, but there is no availability for the three times damages. And then I'll turn it over to Lori to talk about Washington State and their activities in the antitrust.
Great. Thanks, Jim. I think probably as everyone on this call knows, we have a very active attorney general with regard to consumer protection and antitrust issues. So the laws in Washington are similar to the federal. The Unfair Business Practices Consumer Protection Act includes both the concepts of unfair and deceptive acts, and there is a consumer protection division within the attorney general's office, as well as includes the traditional antitrust concepts, and that is there's a division for antitrust within the Attorney General's office. So there are civil penalties and damages and private right of actions that are embedded within the Washington law and that generally mirror what we see in the federal. We wanted to focus in on something that's relatively new in terms of a law that went into effect January 1 of this year that requires prior notice be given to the Washington Attorney General before the effective date of a proposed material change. And so we want to talk a bit about that, but with a little bit of history. The legislative sessions in 2017 and 2018 had a law similar to this, and then it got traction in 2019, but late in the session. So it was subject to significant negotiation. There were a lot of stakeholders in the mix trying to influence the law, and as a result, it's not a model of clarity. So there are a number of unanswered questions. The Attorney General's office is the enforcers, and I think they're working through those questions just as the rest of the healthcare community is. And one of the positive shifts from the healthcare environment organizational perspective is it's a notice statute, not an approval statute. So that was one of the big topics of negotiation in the 2019 session. But it does require notice of certain transactions 60 days in advance. So the definition of material change is one you'll want to look at very carefully in the context of the proposed transaction and includes mergers and acquisitions, and those definitions are fairly straightforward. The one that's creating a lot of complexity for the healthcare organizations is material change in a contracting affiliation, and the language, statutory language, suggests the emphasis is on joint negotiation over rates there and how that joint negotiation might affect the landscape for consumers and payers and others. But the language is not crystal clear, so there's a lot of dialogue on what's a joint negotiation over rates. Is that a routine reassignment of your right to bill? Is it a changing of control with regard to who controls the negotiation or whose contracts you're under? So there's a lot of ongoing dialogue in the context of individual transactions. The penalty for failing to file when you should file is $200 a day. So as organizations are weighing their risk, they're weighing the risk of, I just send in a notice to the Attorney General's office and wait and see, or I don't file and I wait and see, and they might come back and say, you should have filed and have penalties. So the link on the slide is a link to the AGO's form that they want used for their notifications. And I think the experience of the industry so far is, expect the Attorney General's office to review that form carefully. Expect that if they have questions, they may be engaged in interviews with others in the community, be they payers or competitors or others. and you may not know they're having those conversations. And they may ask for more information informally or through, they essentially have a civil investigative demand process built into the statute. It's probably also worth noting that your submission to the Attorney General's office is exempt from public disclosure. So there's a fair amount of proprietary information you might be submitting, and that is protected even though they are a state agency subject to the law. So this is a super important development and a statute that you should review carefully with any transaction in mind because of the ongoing lack of clarity at the moment. So let me turn to Jim to talk about tax-exempt entities and public entities, which have unique considerations as well.
Yeah, thank you, Lori. And on the prior topic, you know, they are, the AG's office is actively reviewing anything that you submit. We recently just submitted on behalf of a client a letter that said, we don't think for the following reasons that this applies, that the notice is required, just to make sure that we wouldn't be subject to the penalties. And we didn't think there was high risk, but you know, within a day of submitting it, it's thank you, we've received it. We've sent it off to this individual to review. And if they have any further questions, they'll get in touch with you. So that's good. And just shows that they're, you know, they are actively reviewing and considering these issues. So next, quickly, I'll go through IRS tax-exempt considerations and just, you know, and that would include whether you're a 501c3, whether you're a supporting organization, or whether you're exempt as a public entity. Some of the things are a little different, but have consistent themes. And the tax-exempt rules can really limit how you can participate in an organization that is for profit when you're thinking about your partnerships. Tax exempt to tax exempt, you have great flexibility. But if you are a tax exempt organization and want to create a joint venture, a partnership, a contract with a for-profit organization, you have to think about, you know, is this an inappropriate use of your charitable or public assets? Is it going to relate? Is it going to create unrelated business income for you that you have to recognize as taxable? Is, if it's not fair market value, is there some private inurement? Are you sharing inappropriately, you know, any of the revenues from the organization? You may have some ability to do that through a contractual or pure joint venture, as long as you're not using bond-financed facilities. If it's bond financed, you cannot share revenues under any circumstances. You know, are you engaged in the excess benefit transaction? You got to look to think, is this going to be something, again, that provides an excess private benefit to someone, so it's an inappropriate use of government or charitable assets? And then, as of 2017, the commerciality doctrine has come into play more often, and you saw it when the IRS denied a couple of applications for exemptions for organizations that would traditionally have been deemed charitable, under the concept that you're really coming in and they were coming in and they were going to compete with for-profit organizations. And the IRS decided, well, because you're competing directly with something that is traditionally a for-profit sector, that it would be unfair to give you a tax-exempt status. So you have to think about those changes as well as you're thinking about how to structure your venture, and especially if you're structuring your venture as a standalone organization and if you're going to try to get tax-exempt status for that standalone organization as opposed to just flow-through status. With that, I think since we're running out of time, we will move on. And I will turn it over to Lori to talk about the remaining statutes of note.
Great. Thanks, Jim. So we're going to go pretty quickly. So these are just other statutes you should have on your checklist. Some are ways of enforcing behavior. Others are different regulatory considerations depending on the nature of the transaction. So good to be comprehensive on your list, and that way you can rule things out pretty quickly, but you don't forget something. So in terms of key takeaways, let me pause and have Jim jump in and wrap us up.
Thank you, Lori. We'll do this really quickly. You know, the key takeaways, we've got continued complexity, and that's made even more difficult with the fact that we're in very difficult and uncertain times. You know, opportunities do exist. You have to think about what your opportunities, how do I leverage the opportunities, and do I have the financial or other wherewithal to take advantage of those opportunities. But with those opportunities, especially in areas that are new, that are pushing the envelope where, you know, it may need to be pushed, there may be significant regulatory risk. And even though we have the Byzantine structure that I discussed, in some cases, there's not the desired defined parameters or framework that you would like to have, to especially whenever you are evaluating risk related to kind of new structures and ideas. And that's what comes in. You know, if you're going to come in and you're going to move forward and you're going to be successful and leverage things fully, you have to implement or work with disruptors and consider their disruptor strategies and how can you disrupt the current status quo. Again, that takes risk, that's change, and that's not something that I think the traditional healthcare providers are really comfortable with, but you know, they may be forced under the current circumstances to think differently about structures. And then perhaps most importantly, one thing we can never forget is even if you're driving through all of these issues, the regulatory complexities, the uncertainty, you've got to be driving towards supporting the community needs. If you don't do that, if you can't do that, then you're certainly going to fail, because if the community does not like what you're providing or somebody else is providing a better opportunity, better quality, and they're better informed, then you're just going to fall to the wayside. That would end the seminar. Thank you very much. And now we'll turn it over to, I believe, Ashley has some final comments.
Yes, thank you. This concludes today's webinar. The CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours directly to all who answered the polling question. A recorded version of the presentation will be available on the Pulsinelli website within 24 hours. Thank you for your participation.
Thank you.